Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, aside from some movie reviews from that person,
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Towards the end of the new film, Selfless, Ryan Reynolds, playing a fabulously wealthy real estate mogul whose consciousness has been placed into the body of Ryan Reynolds, corners the head of the evil corporation that performed the mind swap and calls him psychotic. It's the moment that most makes sense in the movie, because the only way a film can justify the kind of boneheaded behavior exhibited by this particular character, played by Matthew Good, is by labeling him crazy. In fact, the label needs to be applied to the entire corporation this guy runs, an operation whose bizarre business philosophy starts with lying to its affluent and presumably savvy clientele about the provenance of their spanking new bodies, which are not the lab-grown blanks they're supposed to be, but real people so financially desperate with Ryan Reynolds' buff physique, mind, that they're willing to sell themselves to get out of their predicaments. That business philosophy then goes on to treat the brain swap procedure as somehow more secret than nuclear launch codes, so secret that clients are forced to take on new identities. Are people, even rich ones, that desperate for immortality? And so secret that this company, even infused with wads of cash from its well-heeled buyers, somehow finds it financially feasible to deploy an entire undercover army of security people and operatives on each and every client, presumably for life, on the off chance that one of them will have a change of heart and give the game away, and then reacting to any breach of security through the low-profile strategy of torching, literally, everything and everyone the client has come in contact with. By the way, with flamethrowers that for some reason are stored in the control room of their mind transfer facility. Honestly, it'd be more fascinating to see the story of this corporation's devolution. The level of compromise and self-deception involved in going from ambitious medical procedure to a company so evil that it sets a new paradigm for evil movie corporations has to be epic. We don't get that story, sadly. The story we do get, in which Ben Kingsley turns into Ryan Reynolds and then has to seek redemption by helping out the widow of his new body, played by Natalie Martinez, and her young daughter, isn't anything particularly remarkable. It is directed by Tarsem Singh, so everything looks great, particularly during the post-operation, pre-reckoning moments when Reynolds gets to live the good life. There are some cool camera moves and a car chase with a few neat surprises in it, but the notion of this corporation insinuating itself inextricably into its clients' lives is never played up enough to make the paranoia truly delicious, Reynolds never convinces as an aged soul in a 20-something's body, and Kingsley isn't particularly successful in setting up how the person he's playing will morph into Reynolds, and the really wretched attempt at a Brooklyn accent doesn't help. The film is classy-looking and dumb at base. And, by the way, the presentation you've seen of that title as self/less is, not surprisingly, point/less. So, let's stop talking about that and make a note of two more interesting films, both Asian, one that opened last weekend, one that's opening this weekend. At first blush, the Japanese film Jellyfish Eyes looks like someone tried to develop the ultimate family film while on a massive coke bender. The screenplay is an epic mashup of E.T., Pokemon, and the giant rubber monster films known as kaiju. The effects are elaborate, but also a little cheesy. There are plenty of explosions and energy beams and battle sequences, and the children who are the main cast are all adorable. But the director is actually Japanese artist Takashi Murakami, whose style, which he calls super flat, is meant to suggest a cross-fertilization between Japanese high and popular cultures. And as a result, you don't have to dig too deep to find undercurrents not usually present in commercial family fare, primarily among them that the events depicted take place in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Murakami considers himself a disciple of Jeff Koons, so I guess some caution should be exercised. But the film plays so successfully with the blurring of lines between mainstream entertainment and delirious satire that it's hard not to enjoy the onslaught. Jellyfish Eyes is the film Jurassic World should have been. The other film, the one that's opening this weekend, isn't really science fiction or fantasy, but it's just too good not to make note of. The Korean film A Hard Day is the kind of twisted noir that that country has staked a claim to over the past few years, but pushed to the nth level. It concerns a corrupt homicide detective who accidentally runs over an innocent victim on the night of his mother's funeral, and in attempting to hide the crime, opens up a whole mess of trouble for himself that eventually involves drug running, nocturnal grave robbing, and cops even more corrupt than he is. It's only the second film directed by Kim Jong-hoon, but man, is it assured and suspenseful and violent and frequently very funny. I try not to make these reviews sound like shopper's guides. I don't think that's what film criticism should be. But I dug this film so much, I'll make an exception in this case. If you love Korean noir, or just film, frankly, A Hard Day is a thing you need to see. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
And thank you, Dan. Blah, blah, blah. Been working all day with my headphones on all day and didn't really fully properly prepare a show, but we have a good one for you nonetheless. Last week I was at ReaderCon while everybody was paying attention to Comic-Con, people who were dealing with less graphic materials and more prose-based stuff were in Burlington, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, and having a wonderful time, may I say. And I spent pretty much all day Saturday, third day of the con, started Thursday, doing interviews. And because the con area was so filled, I went to the outdoor gazebo area. But the gazebo was constantly filled with people. Fine. Okay. I did about 5 interviews there. And I ended up with my first sunburn in years and years. I'm almost proud of it because I'm such an indoor person. You know, I'm wearing sort of my geeky heart on my sleeve that I don't get out enough to get a sunburn, but I did this time. And so I come back with a number of interviews, one of them tragically lost, and it was one of great interest. But here's an interview with a fellow who is one of the most prominent critic of science fiction. And how can you say he's the most prominent? He won a Pulitzer Prize for it. Not for science fiction, but for reviewing books in general. And that's not quite so common. And this person is Michael Dierda, who's been around for, well, quite a while at the Washington Post. And I should mention that Gary C. Wolfe was one of the guests of honor at ReaderCon this year, and he is prominent, brilliant, great with his stuff. And I'm not qualifying necessarily anything. I'm just saying most prominent because clearly, after you win a Pulitzer Prize, I think it's fair to say that makes you, well, special. Anyhow, it's in glorious stereo with a certain amount of background noise, which I hope you will forgive. And it's unedited, but I don't believe we said anything untoward. So here then, I believe I slayed it and everything right at the beginning, is an interview conducted just this past Saturday in Massachusetts. We are now recording, and I am with Michael Dierda. Mm-hmm. And it's day something or other of three, technically.
By the way, this is ReaderCon. Very stereo. I hope you enjoy that.
Although I got here on the Wednesday, so it's for me day four. Mm-hmm. And today is July 11th, 2015. It is a sunny afternoon, and we are outside in that sun with occasional planes and huge industrial air conditioning occasionally interrupting us, but we don't know that rooms would be made up yet, so we take advantage of it in this manner.
Well, I'll give the listeners a sense of you are there.
Yeah, although I think Murrow had a better quality setup, and he also set up most of his interviews, but they weren't improv. Anyway, you know more about interviews and journalism than most people. So there are three people right now, and I can see them, who don't know who you are.
Oh, well, I can tell you a bit about myself. For many years, I was an editor at the Washington Post Book World. One of the things I was responsible for was the monthly science fiction and fantasy coverage. Earlier this afternoon, or this morning, we talked about how Joanna Russ was important to me in setting up that science fiction coverage. But I was mainly responsible for literature and humanities, arts and letters in the largest sense. I assigned books to people, I reviewed books in those areas, and I continued to do the reviewing. And I was an editor at the Post for 25 years. I got to know a lot of people in the field in the 80s, gaffiated for a while and started coming back about 10 years ago to BeetleCon and various other science fiction conventions.
Yeah, gaffia, for people who don't know, is getting away from it all. And gaffiate is a verb.
Exactly. So, I'm currently a freelance writer in a sense. I'm a contract writer for the Post. I write a weekly review on Thursdays because I was offered a buyout, a voluntary buyout. A lot of people were 10, 12 years ago, and I took it because I thought I could make a go as a writer about books. So I review every week for the Washington Post on Thursdays, great variety of books, some fantasy and science fiction, but a lot of mainstream fiction, biography, intellectual history, almost anything you would think of as in the humanities. But I also write for the New York Review of Books pretty often. I write for the Times Literary Supplement. I write about old books for the online Barnes & Noble Review. I write introductions in the field. Most recently, I did the introduction to the Folio Society edition of Dune. And
it's just having its 50th anniversary.
Exactly.
That
was
right
part
now.
Of the reason they brought the book out this year. It apparently sold well. It's gone into another printing. Folio Society is a kind of ritzy book club out of England. Did Gallant's Masterworks of Fantasy introductions for, most recently, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Before that, the Lord Darcy stories of Randall Garrett and Paul Anderson's The Broken Sword. I've written about all sorts of books. I'm currently at work on a big project about popular fiction in the late 19th and early 20th century. Not just fantasy or science fiction, but detective stories, adventure novels, children's books. This is a period, one generation, when you had suddenly mass literacy after the mid-19th century, and thinking of England particularly, but America as well, when you didn't yet have the competition of radio and TV and movies, so that people turned to magazines, magazine serials, for their entertainment. And you had this wonderful flowering of the genres. Basically, the modern genre literatures were all invented in this one lifetime between roughly like 1860 and 1925. Also, a great number of the iconic figures of our popular imagination, from Peter Pan to Sherlock Holmes to Alice in Wonderland to the Scarlet Pimpernel, Zorro, they all come out of the same period. And so I'm writing a book about the novels and the stories that that became so important to people then, and I think are still important to us, but aren't always read. We know about them from Hollywood, which has traded on the plots and on the characters for years, but the books themselves, I'm urging this book I'm writing, are really a lot of fun to read. Sometimes you have to make allowances for period prejudices and the like, but they're wonderful stories, and I'm trying to finish the book now, and I hope it'll be out in a year or two. But I do have I also have a new book out called Browsings. It's about to come out in a week, and this is basically derives from a weekly essay I wrote for the homepage of the American Scholar magazine online, about what my life was like during 2012 and early 2013 as a book reviewer, book collector, reader. So it's a collection of light essays about all sorts of subjects of bookish interest, along with some rants about this and that. And I think it's, you know, the advance notices that I've been told about, I've been very enthusiastic, and I tried to make these essays charming. I originally wrote them, and then I put them aside and waited 6 months, went back and read them over. I thought, well, they would stand up as a book. They give a kind of self-portrait of me as a freelance writer, and they're fun, I hope.
Somewhere en route, you got a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, yeah. I've won prizes. Although it took a while. When I was in high school, when they had senior superlatives as, you know, your 12th grade, your graduating class, you know, best looking, most intelligent, most athletic, that sort of thing. I came in second on a number of them. And so one of my friends dubbed me most likely to just miss succeeding. And for years, that was my life. But I did win a Pulitzer Prize in 1993, mainly to impress my father. I come from a very working class background, and nobody in my family had gone to college. My father had quit school at 16, and he always, you know, had been told that I was smart, and then he didn't understand why I wasn't really rich if I was smart. That they seemed to go together in his mind. But I had gone into journalism, and I was certainly making a good living and working for a prestigious newspaper. But my father was a difficult man to like, and he never really had much of a kind word for anyone, least of all his only son. So I said, well, I'm going to win the Pulitzer Prize to impress my dad. And so I went out determined to do that. It took me 3 years. And I won it for criticism for my reviews and essays in the Post. Unfortunately, he died 6 months before I won, so he never got to see this. My mother, though, is still alive, and was alive then, obviously, but she's also kind of one of these people who believes in the Tao of the universe. If something good happens to you or members of your family, it means something bad will happen later, and if something bad happens, then something... They're all balanced out. Compensation. So I call my mother up. I say, Mom, won the Pulitzer Prize. Long pause on the phone. And she says, well, guess there's no point in going to bingo tonight. This is a true story, by the way. All the luck had gone out. But I won the an Edgar Award in 2012 for a book I wrote about Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, for a, sort of a nonfiction award they give. And I won an award from the Association for Documentary Editing, which sounds like it would have to do with film, but it's actually the group for scholarly editions, where they give a prize every 2 years for the best essay on some aspect of textual editing. And this was for a long piece I wrote for the New York Review of Books about two annotated editions of The Wind in the Willows and talking about the textual issues involved. So I've lots of different interests, but I would say that my closest friends are people who are involved in fantasy and science fiction. They're cons, notable figures in the field like John Clute I've known for 30 or 40 years at this point. And
interviewed him yesterday about the fourth time.
I first met him about 1981. My first con was 1980's NorisCon 2, the World Con in Boston, where I was happy to go because I at least got to glimpse Alfred Bester. Saw Harlan Ellison rant for two and a half hours about Star Trek. The motionless picture. Yes, a very short one. Isaac Asimov with... surrounded by an entourage. I used to call up Asimov to review for us. He the Post. He wouldn't review. He would write essays or articles. But he always answered his phone. I said, don't you have a secretary? He says, that takes too much time, trouble. I do it all myself.
He was, when I first met him at some Nebula function, when I'm 14, 15 years old, and trying to figure out how to do this radio thing the way my older, but... peers, in a way, were doing it. I went up to him and, Dr. Asimov, could I interview you sometime? Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. how do I get in touch with you? I'm in the book!
Yeah.
So I go and I actually get out the white pages and I look, and there's only one... there are many Asimovs, but only one Isaac Asimov. Didn't say Dr. Isaac, anything like that. I call up and he answers the phone, and I said, it is you. I wasn't sure when I looked in the phone book. He said, I know. I've been trying to get them to list me as the Dr. Isaac Asimov, and they won't do it.
That's great. Yeah, he was such a character.
He was my first interview, and I was his last interviewer.
Wow. Well, I remember the first time I talked to him, Bookworld long ago used to be, as it is again in some ways, just part of the broadsheet, the regular newspaper. There would be four pages of reviews on Sunday. And I was an editor there, a deputy editor. In fact, we persuaded them to go to a tabloid, a pull-out magazine, 16 pages, which it was for 30 years. And for the first issue, I was the guy in charge of getting the stories that would be splashy. So I remember I got a poem from Robert Penn Warren, and I got Ned Roram to give us chunks of his famous notorious diary about music and education. But I had Asimov wrote a piece on called Science and the Sense of Wonder. I went up to interview Walter Jackson Bate at Harvard, who just won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer for his book about his biography of Samuel Johnson. And William Targ, who was a famous editor, write about what it was like to be an editor. And it was a really nice issue. Launched things well.
Yeah.
But I have fond memories of Asimov. But when I went to NorisCon, too, is when I first started meeting SF people.
Now, what year is that?
1980.
That's 80. Okay.
1980.
So I was actually there.
Susan Wood, the late Susan Wood, was sort of my escort guide into the prose area.
Yeah, so, she would be an excellent one.
And I remember going into a party where I noticed this guy in a bowling shirt, some bowling league on the back, and big guy, and tattoos on his arms. And that's how I met Tom Dish.
Right.
Who became a very good friend of mine. I remember sitting in the hallway about 3 o'clock in the morning talking with Barry Malzberg about, science fiction probably on its way, downhill or some gloomy subject like that.
Well, that's what Barry does.
Some Malzbergian take on things.
This is the second ReaderCon he hasn't been.
Yeah, I when I first started coming back here about 7 years ago or so, he was here and we got to be friends again. I mean, I'd seen him, but we didn't really know each other. And we spent a lot of time walking around the parking lot because he likes to get his exercise.
Yeah.
And chatting about writers we both liked, like that weren't as well known as they should be, like Donald Westlake or Walter Tevis, and people who are known, but Barry was a great enthusiast for.
He helped foster the Cordwainer Smith Awards.
Yeah.
Which are given out here.
I once said in a post that it's being an article I wrote, I said that arguably the two greatest writers to come out of Washington, D.C. of the 20th century were both science fiction writers who wrote under pen names and who were spooks, basically intelligence people, Alice Sheldon and Paul Linebarger, who were James Tiptree Jr. and Cordwainer Smith.
Yeah, absolutely. Although Linebarger was only a consultant.
Well, sort of. I mean, I figure brainwashing has to do something with being a spy.
No, they just hire people. The actual agents would just hire people on a consulting basis.
Oh, I see.
And so people, since nobody will ever confirm or deny who worked for them or who didn't work for them, they then say, oh, this is an agent. No.
Yeah.
This is somebody would come up and say, hi, I work with the Central Intelligence Agency, and we'd like to buy you a series of dinners, or we'd like to fund a project or something like that. And that's how it actually works. But then when the story comes out, if the story comes out, they're identified as working for.
Ah. Seems like you know an awful lot about this. A little suspicious.
And speaking of being suspicious, this is WBAI, New York.
We can discuss this off air.
Ah, okay.
Tiptree Sheldon. She was on staff. More importantly, her husband was a continuing worker.
He was supposed to like something number 3 ranked official in the agency.
He was an assistant deputy director of one of the 4 or 5 divisions.
Well, I remember one of the more memorable.
Yes, it is
moments,
suspicious how I know this.
Moments in Washington when Daniel Patrick Moynihan, when he was a senator, decided to have a literary cocktail party up on the Hill. And so I go up there and I get into a conversation about Ezra Pound with Bernard Malamud and James Jesus Angleton. Angleton having been, the famous head of counterespionage and was convinced there was a mole in the CIA and was also tricked by Kim Philby himself. But as a young man, he and Reed Whittemore, who's been his classmate, had founded a literary magazine called Furioso, and they had gone to Rapallo and sat at the feet of Ezra Pound. And so, but it was strange to be talking with Bernard Malamud and this, spy master about Ezra Pound at this cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
But those sorts of things do happen in Washington.
Yeah. They can. My uncle was OSS. And did not stay with the agency when it turned over to the CIA. And he's the one who got me into both science fiction and WBAI.
Wow.
So he had a profound...
Well, some of the people, a good friend of mine, still writing, is, I think, the best American spy novelist of the 20th century, well, now 21st century, Charles McCary. And he never got the attention that Le Carré... got, or some others.
But, or even Donald Hamilton.
Yeah, Donald Hamilton wrote wonderful adventure novels with Matt Helm. But the Paul Christopher books by Macarrier are really insightful. He was, you know, he admits now that he was an agent. But the Tears of Autumn, that must be one of the best.
Actually, I didn't know his name, but I've heard that.
The Tears of Autumn is the truth behind the Kennedy assassination, basically, comes out in the course of the book. But, I one of my big regrets is that I once stepped away for lunch or out to see somebody at Bookworld, and I came back to the Post, and they said, oh, somebody named James Tiptree Jr. called you and didn't leave a number. I missed him. And 3 months later, James Tiptree Jr., that is Alice Sheldon, was dead, so I never did get to talk to her.
Mm.
I think she was trying to find out where Susan Wood was supposed to be writing a biography or a study or something of her, and I think she was just looking for her address, is my impression.
Uh-huh, yeah. But the biography did eventually...
Eventually someone else wrote a very good book.
Yeah, and that book's been optioned as a movie.
Ah.
Pardon me. And at one point...
Was her name Phillips, maybe? Is that right?
Julie Phillips, yes. And that book was optioned as a movie not long after the book came out, so it's probably, Stillwater. But the idea was, and I thought this was a marvelous idea, was to tell the Tiptree story, to do one of those anthology picks where it would then break and portray a story and go back to her life and portray another story. And one of the two stories was to be the women that men don't see.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the first one of their choice was.
Well, but, it does look forward
to it. A biopic of Tiptree would be wonderful. And it was being talked about that it was being purchased by Plan B Productions. That would be Mr. Pitt.
No.
For Miss Jolie to play Tiptree.
Well, that would be something.
Although,
of course, you have this. Presumably, either you have a very shocking beginning and then a flashback, or you have a very sad, shocking ending.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you get around that.
And maybe that's why, because it's been 6 or 7 years since I know that this was in the works, and that may be why it never really.
What we're
happened.
Alluding to, in case people don't know, is that a suicide pact between Tiptree and her husband. And one shot the other and then killed herself.
Yeah, but when he had Alzheimer's, and they knew that this was not going to be a happy end under any circumstances, so she determined the circumstances, and he agreed to it. It's a really sad story about somebody who loved life so much.
Yeah, indeed. But
that's what happened. My image of Tiptree, if I could choose anybody in the world to play her, and time having nothing to do with anything, would be Katharine Hepburn.
I could see that. Yeah, she does. They do have a similar look, and certainly they're the same period in a way. Someone like Jolie was, certainly a star. Doesn't seem to have quite the same inner quality.
But what she had is the money. And that's
when it comes to movies, you can't argue with the money.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it comes down to. Uh-huh. What works would you like to see dramatized? Or what?
Oh.
Or a better question. We can go to both.
Uh-huh.
What biopics of writers?
Well, let's see. First of all, I'd like George Clooney to play me in middle age.
Of course.
Seriously, writers, writers generally don't live all that interesting lives, particularly modern writers. There was a period when you'd read dust jacket biographies, and they would say, Joe Smith has been a lumberjack, a long-distance truck driver, served in the Green Berets, lives in a yurt in Nova Scotia, and, speaks 7 languages. Or that they'd done interesting things in their lives. But now more and more writers, it's a problem, I think, with creative writing programs, is that kids go into these programs right after college, and they write their novel about their unhappy childhood or their unhappy family, and then they're done because they don't know what to write about next because they have never done anything.
Mm-hmm.
And This is less true, I think, in science fiction and the genres, because you do have sort of, to use a fancy word, tropes and themes that run through the whole history of fantasy that you can work on and do variations on, so you're actually thinking story. But people who are more mainstream writers, they exhaust their subject matter because they just don't have enough experience of the world.
Okay, but, what journalists?
What journalists would have a biopic on them?
Yes.
Even, well, gosh.
There was one about a couple of people from the Washington Post.
They did okay, and well, certainly Carl Bernstein would make a more interesting one than Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward is sort of he's a crackerjack reporter, and is got all the connections you could want in D.C. But Bernstein has had a more checkered and colorful life. I mean, the fact that he had these various love affairs and was acted.
There is an outdoor pool and there's an indoor pool.
You know, improperly, perhaps you might say, in some occasions, would make his life look more colorful. Plus, he was a red diaper baby. His parents were socialists. He grew up in Silver Spring, which is where I live now. It's a very working class part of Washington. He would make a colorful figure for one. I always thought the great figure for a Washington movie would be Marion Barry, the famous mayor of
infamous.
Caught smoking pot with prostitutes and still managed to come back. And later I was talking to my friend who lives 10 minutes from me, also in Silver Spring, writer George Pelicanos, who wrote for the Wire TV series and other TV shows, as well as his own well-known gritty novels. He has, in fact, written a screenplay about Marion Barry that's supposed to be in consideration.
Making the rounds.
Or whatever these things do. But
Ben Brantley?
Bradley? I don't know. No, I don't think so.
Catherine Graham.
Well, Kay Graham wrote her memoirs. The interesting thing about Kay Graham was her husband, Philip Graham, who killed himself. So, the thing is, I don't know. No one's ever asked me that question. I don't have a good answer. I would say in general that, you know, most people...
Spur-of-the-moment question.
Yeah, well, that's fine, and I usually can come up with some spur-of-the-moment ideas. But my problem is that I'm a book person. That means that I don't watch a lot of movies. I don't watch a lot of television. I don't do any social media. I kind of try to stay not pure, but I champion of books, and I'm a slow reader. So if I get involved in other aspects of the world of discourse and entertainment today, I don't have time for the books because I move my lips while I read. It just takes forever. But I want to remind people that when a book doesn't need a movie to be validated.
Right.
So often they feel here's the book, but we're really waiting for the movie. The book is what counts, the really good books can't be easily translated into film.
Yeah, I mean, the best books of science fiction, every time I hear they're going to try to make a movie of The Stars My Destination, which is a rumor that comes around about every 10 years, I flinch.
Well, I mean, in some ways I do too, because a lot of that book has to do with Bester's sort of rat-a-tat prose, just boom, 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 boom. On the other hand, since he models a lot of the action after The Count of Monte Cristo, it's a swashbuckling, adventure story as well. So you do have lots of scenes that could, particularly now when we have all these advanced CGI techniques and the like, you could capture them in a way you couldn't 40 years ago.
Well, and 40 years ago when I started doing this radio program, I would rant and rail against the winds about how they shouldn't do any of these. Yeah. They should do none of these books whatsoever. And now I'm beginning to feel a little differently about some of them.
Well, I mean,
we're seeing things like a TV series coming forth of The Man in the High Castle, or at least set in the universe of The Man in the High Castle.
Well, I think what happens, and it's the usual argument for the film, is that it's not the book. It's a different medium, and it's an interpretation of the book. The director is putting his stamp on it. He's giving it a twist. And the best outcome, as far as I'm concerned, is that the movie or the TV series should be be a work of art on its own, but it should also, ideally, lead people back to the original, back to the inspiration.
Which is what I thought the pilot... Did you watch the pilot?
I didn't watch the pilot.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's definitely that universe with that setup, the modern time where... the other side won World War II and all that. But none of the characters of... if there are any of the characters of the book in there, it's a cameo. They walk in and they walk out just to let you know, yes, we read the book. But it's a totally different story in that universe. And it starts in New York and has a character moving west. And when we find out... who's an agent for the I'm sorry, what are the name of the East German police?
I don't remember anymore.
Yeah.
All I remember is Mr. Togomi, I believe.
Yeah.
The Japanese
I mean, in real life, the East German police, the spied on everybody and got your neighbors to spy on you.
Oh, J. Edgar Hoover?
No. East Germany.
Okay.
They had... you know, these special police that paid...
Oh, you mean during the Second World War?
No, I mean after the Second World War. East
the
Germany.
Stasi. Now I remember
Second
it was
World
the
War.
Stasi.
It was East Germany.
Okay.
It was Germany and got bisected.
Yeah, I don't know, but I guess I don't really know the answer to that.
Okay, and I should, but I don't. Or at least not... it'll come to me right after we turn off the mic. At any rate, there... German spy, communist spy police, fascist spy police, going up against the Japanese and the Pacific states, with nobody quite sure what's in the middle, taking that Philip K. Dick universe and writing a whole new story unrelated to the novel in that universe. And well, in a way, that's not bad.
Well, no, this is, in fact, going back to the subject of this forthcoming book of mine, which I'm tentatively calling The Great Age of Storytelling, a lot of these books and figures were adopted by Hollywood, and initially they might give, you know, a straight The Hound of the Baskervilles, but before you know it, we've got Sherlock Holmes in the 1940s, and we've got now Sherlock Holmes of any age, any period, any take on it you want, because they have tried to stay true to some aspects of the original universe that Conan Doyle created, but at the same time to kind of extrapolate, you know, to if this goes on kind of thing, see what else we can do with it.
Yeah.
But at the you know, most of the either
straight
through or they pastiche it or parody it, but it's because the central story has already entered our imagination. You can start to play with it. And I think that helps a lot when you're
and
trying
it's
to
public dummy.
That too. Yeah. That too
helps a great deal. Yeah. Makes the budget easier.
Although we had court cases the last year over whether Sherlock Holmes was in the public domain or not.
And they decided he was.
With some limitations. I'm also a member, an invested member of the Baker Street Irregulars, so about 300 invested members. And the two people involved in that case are both friends of mine. Wes Klinger and John Lellenberg. John Lellenberg was a representative of the estate and was the man who introduced me essentially to the BSI years ago. And Wes Klinger is a friend of mine because I was asked to do the new annotated Sherlock Holmes with Norton years ago. And I said, no, I know a lot about this, but not as much as a number of people I know. And the one I would recommend is Wes Klinger. And Klinger did do those books and did a wonderful job of them and has since gone on to do other annotated editions.
Yeah, I grew up with the William S. Baring.
The Baring Golden. But the point is that they were on rival sides in this court case. Klinger saying that Sherlock Holmes is free and John saying, well, no, I have to protect the trademark, so to speak, for the estate. And John did lose except for the last collection, the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, 1927, is still in copyright. And that actually affects me directly. Because when you're invested in the Baker Street Irregulars, you're given a name from the canon, a name matching your looks, your personality, your job, something about you, sometimes tongue-in-cheek. But mine is Langdale Pike. Langdale Pike is essentially a gossip columnist in a story, the worst story in the canon, I think, called The Three Gables. Holmes, at one time, Holmes turns to Watson and says, Watson, this is a case for Langdale Pike, and I'm going to see him now. Well, once I became Langdale Pike, I wrote a number of stories about Langdale Pike as the real brains of the Edwardian detective world, and Holmes coming to his club was apparently in the story. The Three Gables, we're told he spends his time in his club, and all the gossip of the city comes to him, and coming for help. And anyway, I wrote a number of those without any trouble. But then the last one was for an anthology that Les Klinger and Laurie King, who writes the Mary Russell mysteries, in which Mary Russell is a Jewish American young woman who marries Sherlock Holmes, and they have a number of adventures together, somewhat based on early stories. And basically, I couldn't use the name Langdale Pike because he appears in the 1927 volume. So I retitled my main figure, this particular figure, a lot of cast of characters in the story, with a name that translates, if you work it out, is Pike Langdale. That is, his name is something like Zebulon Andrew Dean, D-E-N-E. So he's named after an American explorer, Zebulon Pike. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a cousin who worked in folklore and fairy tale studies, Andrew Lang. And Dean, D-E-N-E, is a dialect word that means a veil or a dale. So it's Pike Langdale.
So sort of like the horse feather fat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, homage to Phil Dick there.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So,
So since you've done all this BSI work,
yeah,
and you're writing on the early 20th century, what did you think of Solar Pons?
Oh, Solar Pons.
By
those
August
who don't
Derleth.
Know, so, yeah. Solar Thank Pons is a August Derleth, who a lot of people who listen to the show know as the creator of Arkham House, and is an important writer in many ways, an editor himself. Also was a fan of Sherlock Holmes, and he created his a twin of Sherlock Holmes. He actually called the first volume of stories In Re Sherlock Holmes, where Solar Pons is basically Sherlock Holmes, and they have a number of adventures together extending over about, I think, six collections or so.
Mm-hmm.
Many people poo-poo them as being, you know, not very good. I actually think they're, you know, the best are pretty good.
Yeah.
I think they're a lot of fun. I enjoyed them. I do like the early parodies and pastiches. One of the great pleasures of my life was I mentioned I did an introduction to The Broken Sword, but Paul Anderson and his wife Karen Anderson were also members of the Baker Street Irregulars. Karen had founded the Washington, D.C. Scion Society, the local group was called the Red Circle. Back in the 1950s, mm-hmm. calling something the Red Circle was an act of some daring as well.
Yeah.
But Paul Anderson did a wonderful Sherlockian pastiche called The Martian Crown Jewels, where he has a character who's got a name something like Sherlock Holmes, but not exactly solving a mystery on Mars. But just having had a chance to meet him before he died was one of a great pleasure. Traditionally, people at the BSI on one of the nights of the long weekend, which is generally and always in early January, because Sherlock Holmes's birthday is thought to be January 6th. But one of those nights, people stay up till the canonical hour of 2:21 a.m.
Uh-huh.
For homage to 2:21 B. But I like the story.
When did Derleth die? I didn't realize he had been around quite that late.
No, not Derleth. Paul Anderson.
Paul.
Paul Anderson.
Yes, yes.
I didn't. Derleth had already died, although I have friends who corresponded with him. So it was must have lived into the sometime in the 60s or early
70s. Paul I knew.
But there's Derleth even lived into that period.
No, that I did not realize.
Yeah, because
all.
I do have one of the people here at the con, Rebecca Brown. She wrote to Derleth as a young girl. She lived in Minnesota, and he was in Wisconsin. And they exchanged letters. He was very kind and encouraging to her as a reader and writer. And she reveres his memory, since he's now in Lovecraftian circles a controversial figure. It was thought that he was the guy who imposed the idea of the Cthulhu mythos, which is not quite there in the Lovecraft stories. in the way that Derleth thought. Derleth thought it was kind of a good versus evil business, and it's not. But he also, of course, would take Lovecraft's marginal notes, a sentence or two, and turn them into a full-fledged story and say, by H.P. Lovecraft and August Derleth, when, you know, the Lovecraft part was, you know, a sentence.
I didn't realize that he had imposed that byline.
The same sort of thing that happened with Robert E. Howard and the Conan stories for a while.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. At East Books, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I wasn't aware of that. I knew people from the era, like Hans-Stefan Santesen.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He lived into the 1970s and his 80s, late 80s.
Uh-huh.
And he would jog at 5 a.m. to WBAI. Wow. To come into the studio and talk. And he introduced me to a Lovecraftian fan by the name of Willis Conover, who had been the voice of America for a number of years and was... I do radio.
Yeah.
Willis Conover was radio to a large extent. Had the voice and all that. And he loved coming into Hippie Dippie WBAI, although he was what at the time was a bona fide conservative Republican as opposed to what they are today.
Well, one of the things
he brought me an interview. He brought me just show up at the station with, and one day with Sonia Green.
Wow.
So I met Mrs. Lovecraft in like 1971. I think she died in 72.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great pleasures to me about having kind of although I discovered science fiction late, I was 29 when I think, maybe 30 even, when I went to NorisCon 28, 29, yeah, NorisCon 2 in 1980, was that basically all the gods of my childhood and younger years were still around.
Yeah.
They were alive. You couldn't hang out and talk as we are, but you could at least see them. You could see Alfred Bester. And as I said that in the beginning, it was this connection with the past and the fact that fandom seemed to preserve a living tradition of where people were expected to know the writers of the previous generations. And it's something I worry about today. I have this sense that there's grown up a disconnect with the early masterworks of science fiction, even the names that they're not read, they don't have the resonance they once had, a few exceptional figures, a few books, and that there's too much of a focus on what's happening now.
Yeah.
And that the rootedness, the idea of the baton being passed from generation to generation, but the old guys and the first fandom figures, they were still around and they were revered and honored, and you did have this, you know, shake hands with Shakespeare kind of thing when you could touch somebody who had known Lovecraft, who had maybe met H.G. Wells or someone. It was easy enough to do that.
I mean, yeah.
I was thrilled once to meet Virgil Thompson, the composer, because he had worked with Gertrude Stein. They'd done the opera Four Saints and Three Acts, and he used to call James Joyce Jimmy. You know, to hold hand, you know, touch someone like that was a thrill.
Thompson attended a concert where I was giving out the tickets.
He's a very witty guy. I mean, but he used to review books, music concerts for the Herald Tribune. He once was talking about a mass, and instead of the Agnus Dei, he came out in Prince's the Angus Dei, and someone called and he said, "Well, you know, the cow is also a placid, and you know, it would have been a good model as well as the lamb for the Lamb of God."
Yeah, what they called at that time, what they were calling new music.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was some of it was very witty, some of it was not.
Yeah.
I engineered a radio show with where the host was John Cage
for
wonderful. A number of years, and he was a prankster of the highest water.
I went to Oberlin College, and so I was in the college, but I spent a lot of time in the conservatory, so we heard a lot of experimental electronic music, and Cage was, of course, prominent. My wife is a prints and drawings conservator at the National Gallery of Art. And they were just doing some show with John Cage prints. And she says he's a wonderful printmaker, wonderful artist, visual artist as well.
Yeah.
Which I'd sort of known that, but I'd never really thought about him because he's so, you know, such a prominent figure in music alone. But he was a man of many parts.
Yeah, yeah. And
a writer, too.
He actually, Yes, I was aware of that. And thank God, before there were purges of certain things at WBAI, I kept those tapes. I was not a big fan of Cage, but I kept those tapes because I knew how important he was.
Yeah.
And then somebody from, I think it was Brown University, who was doing their doctoral thesis, said, "I understand that you engineered those." And I thought, thank God. And I shipped this guy.
Oh, wow. Must have been thrilled.
Pounds and pounds and pounds of these 10-inch reels at 15 inches per second of Cage talking, playing music, and stuff like that. And then I forgot about it until about 5 years later, where a book came out, and I was in the acknowledgments, and I was thrilled.
Well, it's wonderful when these things do survive in the archive. I mean, the James Gunn and the people in Kansas have a couple of these CDs where you have interviews with, you know, John Campbell and the like, and you get just to see these guys, hear their voices, so you get a sense of what they were like as people. It's quite a thrill.
Yeah, I talked with Gunn about my tape collection, which is mostly reel-to-reel, and I have any number of shows with Alfie Bester and... a few of the greats. Barry Malzberg says one of my shows with Bester was the best radio program you ever heard. But Barry talks in big terms like that. It was where Bester came on my show and read the story, The Men Who Murdered Mohammed, which is a wonderful story.
Well, all our stories are just... I mean, I told earlier today in a panel about reminiscing about Joanna Russ, I'd read science fiction as a boy and as a teenager, but then about 16 or so I kind of gave it up and switched to more serious literature and studies and the like for the next 10 or 12 years at least, and I went to graduate school in comparative literature and studied medieval studies and European Romanticism, but eventually I did get a PhD, but I had come to Washington following my girlfriend, now long my wife, the woman I just mentioned there, and I've ended up after a while working at the Washington Post, where there was only an occasional science fiction column by Algis Budras, and he had to give it up when he took a regular monthly gig at the Sun Times in Chicago. So I said, we should have a monthly column too, and the Post said okay, and you do it. And so I wrote to the only person I knew in science fiction at the time, was Joanna Russ. I'd been at Cornell in graduate school. She was teaching at Binghamton. And a good friend of both of us was a woman named Mary Uhl, who is, if you look at the dedication to the female man, it's to Mary is the second person of the dedicatees. And she'd come up, and we hit it off. We talked. And so I wrote to her. Said, Joanna, you know, what should I have been reading in the last 10, 15 years? What books have I missed that I should be killing? So I have this little mini course from Joanna Russ telling me what I, over the course of 4 or 5 letters, about, you know, books I should read, what I should, you know, look for in them, why they're important. And it was a great, great pleasure for me.
Yeah, every so often I will ask a particular writer when I'm interviewing them, give me a list. I got one from Stan Robinson, Kim Stanley Robinson.
Yes, I remember...
Taught this in Antarctica.
Yeah, he was. I remember Stan lived in Washington for a while. My oldest son and him and his kids were little. They used to play together, and we'd talk. I remember he's a big fan of Dahlgren, and also a big fan of Pillars of the Earth? I think one of the Cecilia Holland books.
Mm-hmm.
He really loved Cecilia Holland. And he had interesting choices.
Stan's a fascinating guy. He really is. One of the most. Well, I'm on the left side of the world, and I would say one of the most astute activist writers.
Oh, yeah.
Out there, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, opening of Red Mars is.
He's managed to combine his sort of social vision with his science fiction vision.
But he's better done than well, most,
and done it much better than others without undermining either.
Yeah,
as some doesn't become tendentious or just
or didactic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry. I know he longed to go back to California, like all Californians, it seems. But I certainly enjoyed having him around Washington for about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, he's about the only. I've only done about 2 or 3 Skype interviews in my life. He's one of them because he's worth it.
Ah.
And by the way, I have to tell listeners, he has a new book out called Aurora. And I'm just two-thirds of the way through and can already tell you, read it.
Good.
So, So, in browsings.
Yes.
What are, this is from about 2 or 3 years ago?
This is from 2012 to 2013. The essays I can, you know, they're just picking up here. There is an essay, in fact, here about ReaderCon, about going to ReaderCon.
Really?
Yes, and I talk about my experiences at ReaderCon. Must have been, I suppose, 3 years ago now. Some people that I met there, I spent a lot of time in the dealer room talking with Bob Eldridge, who used to be the cataloger for Lloyd Curry, who was the premier dealer in fantasy and science fiction. Bob Knowlton, who works in Toronto and used to work at Twilight Zone under the name R.S. Hodgie, and is an incredibly learned figure. But we talk
for
about,
those who don't know, Twilight Zone is a very high-quality magazine, yeah, all too short-lived.
Yeah, under Ted Klein. And yeah. And plus, I come here to see all of my old friends. I see John Clute and Liz Hand, who I believe I introduced to each other at a World Fantasy years ago. I was writing a story about the con for the Post, and at that time I had an expense account, so I took 6 or 8 people out to dinner, and John and Liz were among them, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
And other essays in here are, I wrote a piece about living in Marseille for a year. I lived in Marseille in 1970-71, and Marseille is, you know, one of the really colorful cities of the world, and about my experiences there. The book is, let me stress, these are light essays. In some ways, you know, they the American scholar didn't like to call them like blog essays or blogs, so they were just essays. But it's essentially that way. They're personal. They're intended to be charming, and from all the reports, they are. But I talk about Anglophilia. I talk about ranting at Pepco, the electric utility company in Washington, left us without electricity for a week back during the derecho. And if you have books in your basement and you don't have a dehumidifier, this is a very serious problem. I begin with the first essay is about William Zinsser, a guy who wrote On Writing Well, who just died about 6 months ago.
Right.
He did this slot before me. When he retired, they asked me to take over from him. So I wrote a little homage to him. When I stopped, it was then given to a guy named William Derisiewicz, who wrote this book attacking Ivy League education, and I think it's called, you know, Foolish Sheep, Sheepish Goats, something. Like, I'm sorry if I don't remember the number. But it was very much in the news. But there's one on spring book sales in Washington. I was on the Oxford American Writers Thesaurus. It was revising the thesaurus to include little essays by 10 writers from different sort of backgrounds about their favorite words or least favorite words, and so they'd interrupt things, like these little mini essays. So I was on this with Zadie Smith and David Foster Wallace, and so I talk about what it was like to work on that with these people. And, I don't know. This is the kind of book you would pick up at bedtime, and you would go to sleep with a smile after reading a piece or two. And I should say, this is the very first interview I've given about the book. It's coming out in about 2 weeks, something like that. I think its official pub date is August 1.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to reading it.
I hope for the best. But the world of books is such an iffy business, particularly someone like me who is a dinosaur, who's not on social media. I don't have a web page. I don't have a blog. I don't do Twitter. I don't do Facebook. I basically say, well, here's the book. And it's on its own at this point. And
I haven't noticed Pinchon tweeting a whole lot lately.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't compare myself with Tom.
No, but I'm just saying that... Unestablished writers or newly established writers, millennial writers, if you will, I think they must be on social media to be successful.
Well, I think it's
important.
I don't
think people that have won a Pulitzer Prize need to do the
same. That may be true, but I think if you want to stay, you don't want to. I don't really want to be thought as old fashioned or a dinosaur. I'm not aghast at
social
media.
Well, are there publicists out there?
Yeah, I have a publicist. I have a very good publicist named Iris Blasi at Pegasus, which is a small independent publisher. Did this book, And she just wrote to me yesterday to say that this book was on something, was Library Reads. It was one of the 10 books that librarians apparently recommend to their libraries around the country and to each other.
And if you can just get library sales. Yeah. Billy Stallings, daughter of Will Jenkins, who wrote under the name Murray Leinster. Uh-huh. I always assumed it was Leinster, but she corrected me. It's Leinster. She wrote a biography of her father that's wonderful and fascinating. And she would have liked to have come out for $10 or something like that. She wanted people to read it. And the only place she could get to buy it, and this is after Michael Swanwick helped her shop it around and stuff, was an academic press, and they charge $40.
Well, this is the problem,
But the thing is that she was able to get that sold to this place where they have standing orders with libraries.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that it's going to go, or has gone, into all the school libraries and library systems everywhere, she's able to tell people, you don't need to buy the book. It's in every library. And that's how she has promoted it.
Well,
And by the way, she is on social media, and she's well into her 80s, but she's a sharp lady.
An interesting sidelight, this book is has a striking cover of a stack of books. Is the name Browsings, but the design of the book was by Peter Straub's son-in-law.
Oh, really?
Who's married to the novelist Emma Straub. My name is Michael Fusco. I think he sometimes goes as Michael Fusco Straub now. They've combined their names.
Ah, okay.
And I've always tickled that my friend Peter Straub's son-in-law did the jacket design for this book.
That's great. Is that a coincidence?
Coincidence entirely.
Yeah. Hold up that book, and right here on the radio, I will take a picture of the two of you with it.
Look carefully, radio listeners.
Exactly. And you know what I'll do is when I broadcast this, I'll put this picture on Instagram, and I'll send it to all four corners of the web.
I'm grateful, and I hope a few people at least give the book a try. It's one of those things, there are a number of books about books. But if I have any gift, and I don't mean to sound immodest, I do tend to write with a great affection and enthusiasm about books that people seem to like. I don't think I'm smarmy or saccharine, but who knows?
I find you easy reading.
And it's meant to be entertainment, of literary entertainment, in a sense. These books, and there is a lot of genre stuff in there because during this year I had just begun work on this big project I mentioned about popular storytelling. So I talk a lot about figures like Lovecraft and Conan Doyle, but also less known people like Guy Boothby, who invented Dr. Nicola, or Nicola, depending on how you pronounce it, and William Hope Hodgson. Or I wrote about there's a long piece I already wrote for Barnes & Noble Review on Robert W. Chambers, The King in Yellow, and some
Which
of his other books.
Just came out as an audio book.
And that I used, the hook was, of course, True Detective, which has allusions to The King in Yellow and other, Carcosa and the like. And so there'll be a lot of familiar stuff in this book for fans of the readers and prose in science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
Right. So maybe we can continue this at Catclave.
That would be great.
That would be wonderful. Because,
okay.
Call this an introduction. It's been a long time in my wanting to do it.
Oh, well, so, I'm glad we finally got around to it, and it's been great fun. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
I once loved a sailor, once a sailor loved me, but he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing, and every evening at midnight he would come to my window and sing. See you.
listening to an interview with Michael Gerda, recorded last Saturday at ReaderCon in Burlington, Massachusetts. This is Hour of the Wolf. We'll be back to talk to you in a while.
Sailing away from the clouds, we passed through the Milky White Way. While idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper, I gave him my heart. The sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship.
Come sail away to the stars.
We'll travel to Venus.
We'll sail away to Mars.
No one will see what
Arizona at the turn of the century, astromathematician Percival Lowell was searching for what he called Planet X, 'cause he knew deep down in his soul that an unseen gravitational presence meant a new planet spinning in the air, joining the other eight already known, circling our sun up there. But Percival Lowell died in 1916. His theory's still only a theory. Till 1930, when Clyde Tombaugh, in a scientific query, discovered Planet X, 3.7 billion miles from our sun. A smallish ball of frozen rock, methane and nitrogen. It joined Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Our solar system's newest neighbor, two-thirds the size of our moon. A tiny, barely visible speck, cold, minus 440 below. Not exactly paradise. They named the planet Pluto. That same year, 1930, Walt Disney debuted his own Pluto as well. But a cartoon dog with the very same name as the CEO of hell was not your normal Disney style. Most figured he was riding the coattails of Pluto mania sweeping the land, not unlike our modern love for dolphins and whales. For the next 5 decades, mysterious Pluto captivated our minds. As late as 1978, its own moon Charon was seen for the very first time. But now, telescopes and satellites and computer calculations say that Pluto may not be a planet at all, creating great consternation. Some scientists say that Pluto is a trans-Neptunian interloper swept away by an unknown force, or a remnant of a wayward comet somehow sucked off course. Others say that Pluto is an asteroid and the sun's gravitational pull. But if you ask Clyde Tombaugh, he'll tell you that's all bull. I get hundreds of letters from kids every year, he says. It's Pluto, the planet they love. It's not Pluto, the comet. It's not Pluto, the asteroid they wonder about above. And at the International Astronomical Union Working Group for Planetary System Nomenclature, they too say that Pluto is a planet, reinforcing Clyde Tombaugh's view of nature. Norwegian Carrie Exness, professor at the Theoretical Astrophysics Institute, he too says that Pluto is a planet, and a significant one to boot. But at the University of Colorado, astronomer Larry Esposito says if Pluto were discovered today, it would not be a planet. End of discussion, finito. He says that it was not spun off from solar matter like the other eight planets we know. By every scientific measurement we have, is Pluto a planet? No. And now 20 astronomy textbooks refer to Pluto as less than a planet. I guess if Pluto showed up in a planet convention, the bouncer at the door might have to ban it. St. Christopher is looking down on all this, and he says, Pluto, I can relate. When I was demoted from sainthood, I gotta tell you, little buddy, it didn't feel real great. And Scorpios will look up in dismay because Pluto rules their sign. Is now reading their daily horoscope just a futile waste of time? It takes 247 Earth years for Pluto to circle our sun. It's tiny and it's cold, but of all heavenly bodies, it's Clyde Tombaugh's favorite one. He's 90 now and works every day in Las Cruces, New Mexico, determined to maintain the planetary status of his beloved Pluto. But how are we going to deal with it if science comes up with the proof that Pluto was never a planet? How do we handle this truth? As the PhDs all disagree, we don't know yet who's wrong or who's right. But wherever you are, whatever you are, Pluto, we know you're out there tonight. And in the year 2003, you're going to see the NASA Pluto Express fly by and take pictures of your way cool surface to send to this webpage address. http://doxxx.colorado.edu/plutohome.html. You've got your own webpage, but little guy, you've made quite a splash. Yes, at the turn of the 20th century, astromathematician Percival Lowell, in his quest for Planet X, started this ball to roll. But at the end of the 20th century, we think he may have been a little off base. So we look at the sky and wonder what new surprises await us in outer space. We look at the sky and we wonder.
Well, the song may be just a little bit out of date, but Christine Lavin never will be, never ever will be. And she's updated the song. I think there's a version on YouTube that points out that it was actually demoted. And I think that she said in this version of the song that the flyby was in 2016. Oh my, off by a year. But then this song came out somewhere in the 90s. So
From the album, by the way, Shining My Flashlight on the Moon. I believe that I can actually take credit for giving Christine Lavin her radio debut. I'm not the one who made her popular. Unplugged the wrong thing here. I'm not the one who made her popular. I would say that distinction probably belongs to the magnificent Vin Scalzo. But I was there first. I knew her. I knew her when she was working at Gray Advertising as a temp, and my then what turned out to be my temp wife, which is I was married for like 3 months. My current partner and I are together over 25 years, have not yet made that mistake of getting married, but I did then. And that's how they knew each other, through my ex-wife, Cynthia, now renamed, I won't say to what, was also at Gray and invited this person over and said, "Oh, this is a wonderful performer. You've got to hear it." And it's like, yeah, right. You're on the radio. People say, "Oh, this is wonderful. You've got to see this. You got to hear this," and all that. So Chris Lavin came over to my apartment and took out her guitar and started playing and was like, "Oh, my God, she was amazing." She had not yet recorded a single album. She gave me a cassette tape of her work, including some songs that she has never, ever recorded. And I loaned that tape to somebody some many years back and have never seen it again. This would have been about, 1981 or so. This is a long time ago I'm talking about. And I brought Christine. I was substituting for David Rothenberg, who was then on Wednesday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m., following Hour of the Wolf, which used to be 5 to 7 a.m. And Chris played a couple of songs live on the air. And I suspect, not long after that, she started making big splash on Vinnie Scalzo's show. I don't know whether he was at WFMU yet or whether he was still at NEW or what, but he was still doing his wonderful folky radio show. And I would say it was his broadcasts that made her so popular and famous, justly so. But I think Chris, I haven't seen her in years, I gave her her radio debut. Actually, if you want to see her, she does these concerts online occasionally, and they're free. And what you can do is while you're watching, they're called like laptop concerts, right? They set up a laptop with a webcam in the room, and she and perhaps some other people join in and perform. And if you like it, you can tip them. You can donate money through PayPal or... Yeah, like porn. Not quite, Lister, but yeah. I didn't know. Do they actually do that with porn? I had no idea. So you can actually check that out. I guess Google up or Bing up or... Ooh, that sounds awful. Binging somebody, right? No, that just sounds wrong. Wrong. Googling somebody is invasive enough. But binging somebody sounds like something... Yeah. There's no hope for that.
That's right.
We had a T-shirt, a WBAI T-shirt, that said "Keep Hope Alive,"
And Simon Locally and Max Schmid and I always want, we never did it, we didn't, but we wanted to stencil on the other side of the shirt.
Babu.
Keep, it's too late for Crosby, so that on the other side it would say, keep hope alive.
That's funny.
And on that note, we will begin our outro. With still, oh, I mean, it seems like, ah, helps if you bring up the pot. There we go. Are we there? Are we playing? Ah, now we're playing. I'll learn this board probably as soon as they take it away. This is, of course, Steel Eye Span, the great British folk rock group. Liz Hand has a new novel about the new British science fiction or fantasy novel about such bands as Steel Eye Span. And it's also worth knowing that Steel Eye Span will be playing in New York in just a couple of weeks at the B.B. King Blues Club. An interesting place to go to hear this wonderful music, but check it out. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming to these airwaves in just a few moments. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves. Good morning.
to the lies of pigs, make them imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits, call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn. No.
innocent free. Whether you are me or Mr. Melody, who in a jail for people picnic, yeah. Minority from society, who in a jail for people picnic, the minority is from society. This is an office not viewing. Tell me who is gonna find the jury. Think that too soon I silky. The whole of the rice stove and now they find the judge guilty. This is an office not viewing. Tell me who is gonna find the jury. Think that too soon I silky. The whole of the rice stove and now they find the judge guilty. Judge no one. Judge no one, leave it to Jaja. He's our savior, boy. They're showing the world they are so perfect. There must be God Almighty from no mistake, no make. Your Honor, the one I no need no object. Me want me know if Uno never wrong yet. Whoa, to the four corners of the earth, God Almighty is coming. Oh no no, they want me see if no conscience no bugle no. Almighty is coming to the no no. This is an office not viewing. Tell me who is gonna find me too. In the two spoon I see the whole of the rice stove and all them find me just give me. This is an office not viewing. Tell me who is gonna find me too.
Say we don't have. Surrounded by